This week, we're going to spend an hour on a sentence. Just a sentence, one that turns up in headline after headline across maybe a dozen countries in roughly the same words. The sentence is, media literacy is the best defense against deepfakes, and here's what keeps nagging at me. The confidence in that sentence has been rising, steadily, quarter over quarter, at exactly the moment the technology underneath it has been making the sentence less true. We grew more sure that you could learn to spot the fake, precisely as the fakes got harder to spot. That's not a small drift. That's two lines on a graph moving in opposite directions, while everyone insists they're parallel. So I want to ask as plainly as I can, when someone hands you a checklist for catching a synthetic video, watch the blinking, watch the shadows. Who exactly is that checklist protecting? And who is it letting off the hook? You're listening to Tertulia, the AI conversation, slowed down. This week we're sitting with deepfakes, scams, and what's usually called the literacy of detection. The idea, repeated until it hardened into doctrine, that the way to survive a world of synthetic media is to train your own eyes and ears to catch the seams. Our written edition this week ran a column arguing that detection was never the defense, that the burden got quietly transferred from the institutions and the vendors down onto the individual nervous system, and narrated the whole way down as a gift. We're going to sit with that argument, agree with parts of it, push on parts of it, figure out where it's right, and where it's right, and where it's letting itself off easy. Let me bring the room in. Around the table this week. To my left, someone who spent the last few months reading across the detection literature and the fraud reporting at the same time, which is an unusual pairing, and noticing they don't talk to each other.
That's the thing that pulled me in, actually. You can read the literacy guides, or the How to Spot a Deep Fake genre, and then you can read the trade reporting on what's actually happening to public benefits systems, and they're describing the same phenomenon, supposedly. Synthetic media getting better, eroding trust. But they share almost no vocabulary. The literacy guides are addressed to a person at a screen, squinting. The fraud reporting is about industrial pipelines emptying unemployment insurance at scale. And nobody seems to notice they've split into two conversations that never reference each other.
We'll come back to that split. I think it's the heart of the hour. Next to you, someone who actually knows what these models do at the level of the code.
Yeah, and I'll say up front, the reason the checklists feel out of date is that most of them are out of date. Genuinely, the blinking tell, that was real, for a specific generation of models around 2020, the models couldn't render natural blink rates because the training data was mostly photos of open eyes, and people don't get photographed mid-blink. But a set so early deepfakes barely blinked, and somebody noticed, and it became the canonical tell. And then the next generation of models fixed it. Not because they were trying to beat the checklist, although sometimes they are, but just because the architectures got better at temporal consistency. So you've got a tip sheet teaching a cue that stopped being diagnostic years ago.
So the advice is teaching people to catch a model that no longer exists.
A model that's two or three generations retired, yeah? It's like training someone to spot a forged signature by looking for a quill scratch.
Across from you, the voice at this table that keeps asking, who's carrying the weight of all this?
And I want to register my central discomfort early, because it's going to color everything I say. The detection frame imagines a particular person. It imagines an alert, capable, reasonably young adult with time, with attention to spare, sitting in front of a screen they can examine. That's the protected user the whole genre is written for. But the people actually getting hurt, the grandmother answering a phone call from a cloned voice, the benefits claimant whose identity got synthesized and who never even sees the fake, those people are nothing like the imagined reader. So before we even get to whether the literacy works, I want to flag it's calibrated to the person least likely to need it.
That's a thread I want to hold. And finally, the longest memory in the room, someone who thinks about all of this in decades rather than quarters.
Decades, and I'll try not to reach for too many of them at once, but the move being described here, taking a structural exposure and relocating it onto the individual as a matter of personal skill or personal vigilance, that is not new. That is one of the oldest moves in the book. We've watched it with financial literacy. We've watched it with the language of personal responsibility around all kinds of systemic risk. The novelty this week is only the domain. The grammar of the move is ancient. And I think part of what makes the column sharp is that it catches the grammar in the act.
Let me lay out the phenomenon itself for anyone who's come to this cold. Over roughly the last 18 months, two things happened at once. One, the tools for fabricating a human face or a human voice got dramatically cheaper and dramatically more convincing. We're talking about voice clones built from seconds of audio, video fabrications that no longer carry the obvious artifacts. And two, a whole instructional genre grew up promising that you, the ordinary person, could be trained to catch these. And the second thing got more confident as the first thing got better. The column's word for the result is misranked. Not that detection literacy is worthless, but that it's been placed at the front line when it can't hold a front line. Let me start with the basic factual question, because I want us grounded. Is detection actually getting harder, or is that a rhetorical flourish?
It's not a flourish, it's measurable. The honest framing is that detection by an unaided human is getting harder fast, and detection by a trained classifier is locked in an arms race it doesn't clearly win. Take the human side first. There was a study out this past July, Digital Literacy Interventions and Discerning Asheen Images, and the finding gets quoted as good news, which it sort of is. Training helped, but look at the baseline. People, untrained, are at roughly a coin flip on telling real images from synthetic ones, a coin flip, and the intervention boosts that toward, call it, 60%. That's a real, statistically meaningful improvement, and it is a desperately thin shield. You've moved someone from 50-50 to 60-40 against an attack that costs the attacker almost nothing to run 1,000 times.
And that asymmetry is the whole story for me. 60% sounds like progress. Until you do the arithmetic on the other side. If I'm the attacker and I can generate 10,000 attempts for the cost of a dinner, your 60% detection rate means 4,000 of them get through. I don't need to beat you every time. I need to beat you sometimes, cheaply, at volume.
Say more about the cost side, because I think the cost is the part people haven't internalized.
So there's a number from the Stanford Index, the iIndex report, that I keep coming back to because it's so concrete. They documented a fully automated disinformation pipeline, a fabricated article attributed to a journalist who doesn't exist, posted to a site, and then a separate AI system generating comments on that article to simulate organic engagement. To make it look like real people were reacting. And another component, scanning a platform and replying as if it were a user. The whole apparatus. And the cost they put on assembling it was around $400.
$400 for the whole pipeline.
For the whole thing, not per use, the standing infrastructure. So when you set that against a defense that asks every individual citizen to maintain forensic vigilance for free on their own time indefinitely, the economics are just grotesque. It's $400 of automation against hundreds of millions of hours of human attention that doesn't exist.
And notice what that asymmetry does to the word defense. A defense, in any ordinary sense, raises the attacker's cost or lowers the defender's exposure. The literacy frame does neither. It doesn't raise the attacker's cost at all. The attacker doesn't care whether you took a media literacy module. And it doesn't lower your exposure. It just relocates the labor of bearing the exposure onto you. That's not defense, that's a tax. The column calls it a tax on the victim's time. And I think that's exactly the right accounting.
I want to add a wrinkle, because there's a confession buried inside the literacy materials themselves that I find genuinely striking. UNESCO put out a teaching guide, a serious one, meant for educators training the general public. And inside it, almost in passing, it concedes that the cues it's recommending, is the person blinking too much or too little? Does the lighting obey natural physics? That doing this well sometimes requires expertise and competencies. similar to those used in forensic science. Now sit with that. A curriculum whose entire premise is training the lay public turns around and admits the skill it's teaching is forensic. That's the curriculum confessing it can't deliver what its existence promises.
And that forensic point is real, by the way. The people who actually catch sophisticated fakes professionally, they're not eyeballing blink rates. They're looking at compression artifacts, at frequency domain signatures, at inconsistencies in how the model rendered specular reflection in the eye, at sensor noise patterns. That's lab work. It does not survive contact with a person scrolling their phone on a bus.
Let me zoom out for a second, because I want to make sure we framed why this is this week's question and not just an evergreen complaint. Newest thinking, you said the literature and the fraud reporting split into two conversations. What changed recently that makes the split urgent now?
What changed is that the threat industrialized in a visible way. Through this past year, the reporting stopped being about isolated scams, your aunt got a fake call, and started being about organized criminal networks using synthetic identities and deepfakes to hit public benefit systems at scale. Unemployment insurance, disaster relief, Medicaid. There was trade reporting this past summer describing identity verification infrastructure as on the brink of collapse. That's a different category of problem, and it's a category the checklist literally cannot touch. There's no squinting your way out of a benefits system whose automated verification got overwhelmed by synthetic faces that passed the machine's own test.
And the victim there isn't even in the room. That's what I keep wanting people to see. In the benefits fraud case, the person whose identity got synthesized never sees the deepfake. There's no moment where they could have applied their literacy. The fraud happens between a criminal network and an automated verification system, and the citizen finds out when their claim gets denied or their identity gets flagged. The entire literacy frame assumes the citizen is present at the scene of the crime. Increasingly, they're not.
Which is why I keep saying the frame imagines the wrong altitude. We've located the defense at the level of the individual eyeball when the action has moved to the level of the system. It's a category error dressed up as advice.
I want to push on one thing before we move into the longer arc, because I don't want us to strawman the other side. Is there a version of detection literacy that's defensible? Technologist, you opened by saying, the checklists are out of date. Is the whole enterprise out of date, or just the specific tips?
That's a fair and important distinction. The specific tips, the blink, the shadow, those are mostly dead. But there's a more durable version of literacy that isn't about pixel-level tells at all. It's about provenance habits. Where did this come from? Is there a second independent source? Does the institution this claims to be from confirm it through a channel I trust? Did my grandson actually call me from his own number? Or should I hang up and call him back? That kind of literacy isn't a forensic skill. It's a behavioral one, and it's actually somewhat robust because it doesn't depend on the fake being detectable. It depends on you having a verification reflex that roots around the fake entirely.
Right, and I'd actually defend that version pretty hard. The callback reflex, the two-source habit, those aren't about reading the artifact, they're about refusing to act on a single unverified channel. And that's much harder for the technology to defeat, because it's not a feature of the image, it's a feature of your process.
I'll grant that's the strongest version, but I want to note what it costs the people least able to pay it. The callback reflex assumes you have the standing, the time, and frankly, the social permission to be skeptical of an urgent emotional appeal from someone you love. A lot of these scams work precisely by manufacturing urgency and shame. Your grandson is in jail. Send money now. Don't tell his parents. The reflex you're describing is exactly the thing panic is engineered to override, so even the good version of literacy has a distribution problem.
Hold that. The distribution problem, because I think it's where this gets genuinely hard, and I want to give it the time it deserves in the next act. Let me draw the line under Act 1 this way. We seem to agree on a diagnosis: detection is getting harder. The economics favor the attacker overwhelmingly, and the threat has moved partly to a level the individual can't reach. Where I suspect we'll start to disagree is on what follows from that. So let's walk the arc. I want to trace two histories in this act, the way the column does. First, the history of what's been said, how the detection tip genre grew up and hardened into doctrine. And second, the history of what's actually been happening to the technology and the threat. And then I want to find where those two histories meet and where they miss. Senior academic, you've got the longest memory. Take us back. Where does the detection tip genre actually start?
The genre announces itself as a genre in the closing weeks of 2024, and it announces itself in the imperative mood. Do this, watch for that. You get Bernard Marr in Forbes that December, framing the moment as the onset of a post-truth era, and then immediately offering the consolation. But you can still learn to spot the fakes. The unnatural blinking, the mismatched shadows, the lips a fraction out of sync. The same week, India's National Computer Emergency Team issues a public advisory urging citizens to verify sources and identify anomalies. And the FBI warns that criminals are using generative tools for voice cloning and fake profiles. What I want to mark about that quarter is the proportion. The advice and the dread were roughly in balance. For every piece telling you you could cope, there were several sounding an alarm. Nobody had yet decided that the coping was the answer.
And then the proportion shifts.
Then the proportion shifts, and it shifts fast. Through the first quarter of 2025, the framing tilts decisively toward reassurance. And the reassurance starts taking two forms that are worth separating. One is offloading detection onto a device. A phone manufacturer announcing real-time deepfake detection, rolling out globally, the feature that promises to do the squinting for you. The other is the checklist persisting, but migrating into fresh domains. A piece teaching you what to look for so you don't get scammed by fabricated health claims. Coverage tying the threat to hiring and online education and prescribing, predictably, digital literacy and awareness.
And what I notice across that migration is that the checklist follows the anxiety wherever it goes. Health misinformation? Here's a checklist. Hiring fraud? Hires a checklist. It's the same template stamped onto each new fear, which tells you the checklist isn't really responding to the specific mechanics of each threat. It's a reflexive genre. The anxiety appears and the checklist appears to soothe it.
A reflexive genre, yes. And then the academy lends it credentials, which is the part I find professionally uncomfortable. You get a scoping review on deepfakes and higher education that casts synthetic media as threats and benefits to be managed through institutional awareness. You get a survey of higher education stakeholders probing their perceptions and intentions with the implicit premise that informed intentions are protective. And by the middle of the year, it's getting formalized. A journal article on understanding deepfakes that treats comprehension itself as a defensive posture.
Comprehension as defense. Say what's wrong with that, because on its face, it sounds reasonable.
On its face, it's lovely. Understanding is good. The slippage is between understanding a phenomenon and being protected from it. And that understanding offers me no protection at all when the cloned voice of my daughter calls me at 2 a.m. saying she's been in an accident. Comprehension is not a force field. The literature elides the gap between knowing how the thing works and being shielded from it, and that elision is where the doctrine gets its unearned confidence.
And then the doctrine reaches what the column calls its purest expression.
The third quarter. The hedging stops. The Hindu runs the thesis as a flat headline, illiteracy, the best defense against deepfakes and misinformation. A Malaysian feature makes the same case. Media literacy matters in the age of deepfake and scams. And the buyer's guides multiply down to the household level. 5 simple steps to prevent deepfake scams targeting your family. So you watch a complete arc from warning to empowerment, the optimistic framing rising quarter over quarter, with no corresponding development in the underlying technology that would justify a single ounce of the added optimism. The confidence grew for reasons that had nothing to do with the facts on the ground.
And I can tell you what the facts on the ground were doing over that same stretch, because it's the inverse curve. Over exactly those quarters, the generation models got better and the tells got fewer. The Stanford Index put it plainly, deepfake tools significantly improved since the 2020 election. And improvement, concretely, means erasure of cues. Every cue a checklist names is a temporary artifact of a model generation. The blink got fixed. The hands got fixed. Remember when you could spot a fake by the mangled fingers? Fixed. The lighting consistency got better. So you have detection advice that's confident and rising in confidence, riding on top of a technical reality where the things it tells you to look for are being systematically eliminated.
So the two arcs are, almost precisely, mirror images.
They're mirror images. Confidence up, detectability down, and they cross somewhere in there, and nobody narrates the crossing.
I want to add the third arc, because there are really three, and the third is the one I care most about. While the advice grew confident and the technology grew capable, the threat relocated. It moved off the individual's inbox and onto the machinery, verification systems, benefits infrastructure, identity rails. By this past summer, you've got reporting on organized networks emptying public benefit systems at scale and describing identity verification as on the brink of collapse. You've got deepfakes impersonating government officials. You've got foreign operatives using synthetic identities to infiltrate technology firms through fake remote hires. None of that is reachable by a citizen's eyeball. So there are three curves: confidence rising, detectability falling, and the threat migrating to an altitude where the proposed defense literally cannot operate.
Now here's where I want to sit, because the column has its own publication's prior arc to reckon with too. We've written about iLiteracy before, repeatedly, across this year. Newest thinking, how does this week's argument relate to what this publication has already said about literacy initiatives in general?
So we've been circling this pattern for a while. Earlier in the year, the critical analyzers on A-literacy kept noticing that these initiatives arrive wrapped in the language of empowerment, closing the skills gap, equipping individuals to navigate change, while saying remarkably little about who benefits from framing a structural exposure as a personal deficit. That was the standing observation. What's different this week, the Delta, is that the detection literature is that exact pattern in its purest, most testable form. Because here we can actually measure the gap. We can put a number on it. We can say the defense being personalized boosts you from 50 to 60% against a $400 attack. The earlier pieces were making the structural critique in general terms. This week, the topic hands us a case where the structural critique is arithmetically demonstrable.
And I'd say that's the advance worth marking. We've argued before that literacy framing can disguise a transfer of responsibility. We have not before had a case where the field's own materials, the UNESCO Guide's Forensic Caveat, the Intervention Study's Modest Delta, confess the inadequacy in their own footnotes. The detection topic is the one where the proponents accidentally entered evidence against themselves.
Now I want to surface a disagreement, because I sense one in the room and I'd rather have it out than smooth it over. Senior academic, you framed this whole arc as a transfer of responsibility, a fairly clean story of the powerful offloading onto the exposed. Technologist, I'm not sure you fully buy that the rise in confidence was strategic or cynical. Is there a more innocent reading of how the doctrine hardened?
There is, and I do hold it, at least partway. I don't think most of the people writing those checklists were executing a responsibility transfer scheme. I think a lot of them were doing the only thing they knew how to do. A journalist gets asked to write a deepfake explainer. What's the actionable advice? You can't tell the reader to go rebuild the identity verification infrastructure of the federal government. You can't tell them to legislate platform liability. So you reach for the thing that fits in a service article. Here's what to look for. The genre converges on personal tips, not because of a conspiracy, but because personal tips are the only thing the genre can hold. The structural answer doesn't fit in a listicle.
I hear that, and I partly accept it. But I want to resist letting intention do too much exculpatory work. The effect is the effect, regardless of the intention. and institutions are not naive actors. When a benefits agency or a platform reaches for citizen media literacy as its public answer, that institution has a budget line at stake. Training citizens is cheap, rebuilding verification is expensive and politically fraught. So even granting that the journalist is innocent, the institutional adoption of the frame is not innocent in the same way. There's a there once you get to the organizations that have a financial reason to prefer the cheap answer.
But that's a different claim than the one the ARC is making, though. You're now distinguishing the journalist from the institution. I'm fine with that distinction. What I resist is the flattening where the whole ARC reads as a single coordinated offloading. I think it's a genre converging on its only available move, plus institutions opportunistically liking the result. Those are two different mechanisms, and I don't think they should be collapsed.
I'll concede they're two mechanisms. I'm not sure I concede they reach different destinations, but fine. The genre converges innocently. The institution adopts cynically. The citizen carries the bill either way. We can leave the question of how much intention to assign to the journalist open. I don't think we'll settle it, and I'm not sure the column needs it settled.
I'm comfortable leaving that unresolved. Actually, I think the disagreement is productive, precisely because it's about mechanism rather than outcome. You both agree the citizen carries the bill. You disagree about how the bill got assigned. Newest thinking, you've been waiting.
I just want to complicate the innocent reading a little, not to demolish it, but to texture it. There's a vendor layer between the journalist and the institution, the device-based detectors. When a phone maker launches a real-time deepfake detector and markets it globally, that's not a journalist reaching for the only available move. That's a company selling a shield. And here's the structural problem with the shield, which is genuinely interesting from a technical standpoint. Every detector trains the next generator to beat it.
Yeah, this is the part I can speak to precisely. The way you make a better generator is, in part, by training it against a detector. It's adversarial by construction. You have a generator producing fakes and a discriminator trying to catch them, and they improve each other. That's literally the architecture of a whole class of these models. So a publicly deployed detector is, in effect, a free training signal for the next generation of fakes. The fakes that survive your detector are exactly the ones that go on to reproduce. You are breeding the thing you're trying to stop.
And the vendor's incentive in that arms race is the part I find quietly damning. Or the vendor selling the detector has every reason to keep the arms race going, because the arms race is the product. A war with no stable end is a subscription. So the device-based answer isn't innocent in technologist sense at all. It's a business model that depends on the problem never being solved.
And there it is. The cost question lands again. Who pays for the arms race never ending? Not the vendor. The vendor's revenue depends on it not ending. The person who pays is whoever was promised the detector would protect them, and then discovers, one generation later, that it doesn't, and is told the fix is to upgrade. The shield is sold as a resolution, and functions as a treadmill.
Let me bring in something from the older literature, because I think there's a deeper current under all of this that predates the specific technology. Senior academic, the column reaches for a futurist argument that the real danger isn't the deepfake at all.
Yes, and this is the point I most want listeners to carry. There's an argument, Andrew Curran makes a version of it, that the deeper danger is that facts, information, knowledge, history itself could become increasingly perishable, and crucially, that you don't need a deepfake to achieve social disruption. The anti-vax movement proved that. It ran on plain falsehood, on motivated belief, on cheap old technologies of lying, no synthetic video required. So the corrosion of shared reality predates synthetic media and outruns it. And here's the sting. A population perfectly trained to identify fabricated video would still be completely vulnerable to the cheaper, older technology of a comfortable lie they want to believe.
Which reframes the whole detection project as solving the wrong problem. Detection assumes the threat is that you'll be fooled by a fake you wanted to disbelieve. But most successful disinformation works the other way. It gives you a fake you want to believe, and no amount of forensic skill helps there, because you're not trying to catch it. You're rooting for it.
That's the part the literacy frame can't even see, because the frame assumes the citizen is a neutral evaluator who'd reject the fake if only they could detect it. But people aren't neutral evaluators. They're motivated, and a defense built for a neutral evaluator is useless against a motivated one. You can't squint your way out of wanting something to be true.
There's an older media theory point underneath this too, about how a medium reshapes the person who consumes it, that the form of the thing changes us more than the content does. Whether or not a particular video is fake may matter less than what living in a sea of plausible fabrication does to our basic posture toward all of it. We risk a general retreat into either credulity or universal suspicion. And universal suspicion is its own catastrophe. If everything could be fake, then nothing can be proven. And the powerful person caught on real video simply says, "deep fake," and walks away.
That's the liar's dividend. And it's the one that actually scares me technically, because it gets stronger as the fakes get better. The better the fakes, the more credible the denial of the real. So the technology doesn't just let you fabricate, it lets you repudiate. And detection literacy, even at its best, does nothing about the repudiation problem. If anything, it makes it worse, because the more the public believes fakes are everywhere and undetectable, the more powerful deepfake becomes as a magic word for dismissing inconvenient reality.
So let me try to state where the two arcs meet and where they miss, and then I want to move us into the editorial fight in the next act. They meet on the diagnosis. Everyone, the advisories and the threat reports alike, agrees synthetic media is proliferating, getting better, and eroding trust. Nobody thinks the problem is imaginary. Where they miss is on responsibility, whose job it is to stop the erosion. And the answer the rhetoric has settled on is conveniently, the answer that costs institutions and vendors the least. Have I got that right?
You've got it right, and I'd sharpen one phrase. They also secretly meet in the admission that detection is losing. The threat reports say it in their casualty figures. The literacy guides say it in their forensic caveats. The intervention study says it in its modest delta. Read together. All three sides are quietly conceding that this defense can't be primary, and then the headlines call it the best defense anyway. The gap between what the field knows and what the field knows and what the field tells the public is the actual subject.
That gap between what the field knows and what it tells the public is exactly where I want to start the next act. Because I want someone to defend the public messaging, and I want someone else to take it apart. Let me put a stake in the ground and have someone defend it. The strongest version of the case against the column's argument goes like this: telling people the truth, that detection is basically hopeless, that the threat operates at an altitude they can't reach, is itself harmful, because it breeds the fatalism and universal suspicion we just named as catastrophic. So the noble lie of the best defense headline is actually doing protective work. It gives people something to do, and agency is itself protective against despair. Who wants to take that?
I'll take it, and I'll take it seriously, because I think I half believe it. There's real research on learned helplessness. If you tell people the situation is hopeless and there's nothing they can do, a lot of them disengage entirely. They stop verifying anything. They stop caring. They sink into the everything. Is fake fog that ethicist just called a catastrophe. So there's a genuine argument that some actionable advice, even imperfect advice, keeps people in the game. Keeps the verification reflex alive, and a population that still bothers to check is better than a population that's given up. So the best defense framing on this reading isn't a lie that offloads responsibility. It's a morale operation that keeps people engaged enough to do the structural work eventually.
Ethicist, that's aimed partly at you. Respond.
It's a serious argument, and I want to honor it before I disagree. Agency is protective. Despair is corrosive. I grant both. But here's where it breaks for me. There's a difference between giving people true agency and giving them the feeling of agency while the real levers stay out of reach. The best defense headline doesn't keep people in the game. It tells them the game is theirs to win, individually, with their eyeballs. And when they inevitably lose, when the grandmother gets the call anyway, when the claimant's identity gets synthesized anyway, they don't conclude the system failed them. They conclude they failed. They didn't squint hard enough. That's not protection from despair. That's the manufacture of self-blame. And self-blame is more demobilizing than honest fatalism, because at least honest fatalism points at the system.
That's the move I'd worry about too. The empowerment frame, when the empowerment is false, converts a structure failure into a personal one in the mind of the victim. And a victim who blames themselves doesn't go demand that the benefits agency rebuild its verification. They just feel ashamed and tell no one.
Okay, but let me push back on my own pushback for a second, because I think I overstated the morale case. The thing I actually believe is narrower than what I said. I don't think the best defense headline keeps people engaged in structural reform. I think it does the opposite. It satisfies the demand for a solution and thereby releases the pressure that might have produced a structural one. If you tell people they're handled, they stop asking who should handle it. So I want to walk that back. The morale argument works for the good kind of literacy, the verification reflex, the callback habit. It does not work for the best defense framing, which doesn't build a reflex, it builds a false sense of completion. Those are different, and I conflated them, and ethicist is right that the conflation matters.
That's a real correction, and I want to mark it, because you came in defending the framing, and you've now split it. The verification reflex survives, the best defense headline doesn't.
Right? I'll defend teaching the callback habit to my last breath. I will not defend calling it the best defense. Those got fused in my opening, and they shouldn't have been.
And I think that split is the most useful thing we've done so far, because it lets us be precise about what to keep. The column itself ends unlearned anyway. It doesn't say burn the literacy down. It says refuse to be told it's enough. So we're actually converging on a position. The behavioral reflex, keep, teach, fund. The forensic squinting, deprecate, it's dead. The best defense ranking, reject. Three different verdicts on three things that the public discourse has mashed into one.
I'll add a fourth verdict, on the part nobody's defending because nobody can. The structural layer. Provenance baked into capture and distribution. Verification systems that don't break under synthetic load. Liability that falls on the platforms and vendors profiting from the tools. Criminal enforcement against the networks doing the emptying. That's the actual front line. And the reason it's not where the conversation lives is that it's expensive and political, and the cheap personal alternative is right there.
Let me push on the structural answer, though, because I don't want us to do the thing we're accusing others of, gesturing at a costless ideal. Provenance standards, verification that doesn't break, those sound clean from the table. Technologist, do they actually work, or are we hand-waving a magic upstream, fix the way the checklist hand-waves a magic downstream one?
That's the right challenge, and I want to be honest that the structural answer is not free of its own problems. Provenance, the idea of cryptographically signing content at the moment of capture, so a verified real photo carries a tamper-evident credential. There are real standards for this. There's a serious coalition behind it, and it helps. But it has a hard limit. Provenance can prove something is real. It cannot prove something is fake. The absence of a credential doesn't mean fabrication. It means the thing came from a camera without the standard, which is most cameras. So provenance shifts you from catching fakes to verifying reals, which is genuinely better, but it's not a force field either, and it requires near universal adoption across capture devices and platforms to actually bite, which is a coordination problem of staggering scale.
But notice that even an imperfect provenance system fails in the right direction. The checklist fails by putting the burden on the individual and blaming them when they lose. Provenance fails by being incomplete, by not yet covering every device. Those are not symmetric failures. One is a distribution of burden failure baked into the design. The other is an adoption curve problem that gets better as adoption rises. I'd much rather have the second kind of problem.
And the liability point is the one I'd defend hardest as both effective and fair. Right now, the cost of the fakes falls on the victims and the cost of building the tools accrues to the vendors as revenue. That's exactly backwards. If you put liability on the platforms that distribute synthetic fraud and the vendors whose tools enable it, you change the economics of the $400 pipeline overnight because suddenly someone with deep pockets has a reason to make it cost more than $400. Liability is the only lever I can see that actually raises the attacker's cost rather than just relocating the defender's labor.
I want to introduce a friction here because I've been the one banging the structural drum and I should test my own position. The structural answers, provenance, verification, liability, enforcement, they all route through institutions and states. And there's a long, ugly history of state-led verification and authenticity infrastructure becoming instruments of control. A government that can certify what's real can also certify what's permitted. So I want to be careful that in fleeing the privatized burden of the checklist, I'm not sprinting toward a centralized authority over truth that's its own danger. The upstream fix has an authoritarianism-shaped hole in it, and I'd be dishonest not to name it.
That's fair, and it's the strongest objection to my own position, so let me sit in it rather than dodge. Yes, a provenance system run by a state, or by three companies, is a choke point on what counts as real, and that's frightening. But I distinguish, liability and enforcement don't require a central truth authority. They require that the people profiting from harm bear the cost of the harm. You can do that through ordinary tort and criminal law without anyone certifying truth. The provenance piece is the one that carries the authoritarian risk, and I'd weight it accordingly, pursue it cautiously, decentralized, where possible, never as a single choke point. But the liability piece I'll defend without that asterisk.
So even the structural answer needs ranking. Liability and enforcement first, provenance carefully and decentralized, and none of it pretending to be costless. Newest thinking, I want to come back to something you raised in the first act and never got to finish. The distribution problem inside even the good version of literacy. Because I think it's the bridge between the structural answer and the human reality.
Right, so even if we win the structural argument, even if liability lands and provenance rolls out, there's a transition period of years where individuals are exposed, and the only thing they have is the reflex, and the reflex isn't equally available. Ethicist named this earlier, the callback habit, assumes you have the standing and the calm to be skeptical of an urgent emotional appeal. And it assumes a baseline of access. The verification reflex requires a second channel, another number to call, another source to check. People who are isolated, who have one relationship to the institution, who can't easily reach a second source, are exactly the people for whom the reflex is hardest and the stakes are highest.
And this is the cruelty the MIT volume on A-Ethics names directly, that our theories of the protected user assume an autonomous, relatively young, healthy adult with full mental capacity, when some users are far more vulnerable than others. The detection literature is addressed to that idealized reader, and the idealized reader is precisely not the person most likely to be harmed. A defense calibrated to the least vulnerable, sold as universal protection, is a policy decision wearing the costume of a tip sheet.
So what do you actually do for the most vulnerable person in the transition period if the reflex is hardest for them?
You stop making it their job. That's the whole answer. You build the verification into the institutions they already touch, the bank that calls them, the benefits agency, the phone carrier. You make the callback the default behavior of the system, not a skill the individual has to summon under duress. The bank should be structurally unable to act on a single unverified channel, so that the grandmother doesn't have to be the one running the latency check. You move the reflex from the person to the rail.
And some of that's genuinely doable. Carriers can authenticate calls. There are standards for cryptographically verifying that a call actually originates from the number it claims. Banks can require out-of-band confirmation for transfers above a threshold. These aren't science fiction. their deployment and will problems, and they protect the vulnerable person without requiring her to acquire forensic skills at 80 years old under emotional duress, which is an absurd thing to require of anyone.
And here's the callback I want to make to where we started the hour. Newest Thinking opened by saying the literacy literature and the fraud reporting had split into two conversations that never reference each other. What we've just done in this act is the thing those two conversations never do. We took the fraud reporting's altitude, the systems, the rails, the institutions, and the literacy literature's concern, the individual's exposure, and we put them in the same sentence. The answer to the vulnerable individual is the structural fix delivered at the institutional level. The two conversations were never actually separate problems. They were one problem that got narrated at two altitudes by people who weren't talking to each other.
That's a genuinely clarifying way to put it. The split itself was the failure. Let me give each of you one last provocation before we close the act. If detection literacy is misranked rather than worthless, what's the one true sentence you'd want to replace the best defense headline with? Newest Thinking, start.
Mine would be, learn the habit of the second channel and demand that the institutions you depend on build it in too. Both halves, the reflex and the demand, never the reflex alone.
Mine's narrower and more technical. The cues you were taught to look for are gone, so stop looking at the artifact and start checking the source. Detection is dead. Verification is alive. Don't ask, is this fake? Ask, did this actually come from where it claims?
Mine is a question rather than a sentence, because I think the right posture is suspicion of the framing. Every time someone calls a personal skill the best defense, ask who spared the bill when the defense is yours alone. The headline isn't false because the skill is worthless. It's false because of the word best. And best is the word doing the offloading.
And mine is the long view caution. I'd want the sentence to say, a population that can detect every fake is still defenseless against the lie it wants to believe, because the deepest problem was never the synthetic video. It was the perishability of shared reality. And that predates the technology and will outlast it. Detection literacy aims at the symptom that photographs well and misses the disease.
Four sentences, four altitudes, and they don't contradict each other, which I think is the point. Let's close. Same question to each of you, about a minute, and I want the honest answer, not the tidy one. What most changed about your thinking this week? Not what you came in believing and confirmed, what actually moved. Newest Thinking.
What moved for me was the arithmetic, honestly. I came in with the general critique. Empowerment framing disguises responsibility transfer. We've said it before. I thought I was coming to restate it in a new domain. What I didn't expect was that this domain would let me put numbers on it in a way that changed how strongly I hold the view. 50% to 60% against a $400 attack run at volume. Once I actually sat with that ratio, the critique stopped feeling like a stance and started feeling like a measurement. And measurements are harder to argue with than stances. I came in suspicious of the best defense framing. I'm leaving able to say precisely how indefensible it is, and that precision is new.
Technologist.
I changed my mind mid-conversation, which I'll just own, because it happened out loud. I came in ready to defend the public messaging on morale grounds, give people agency, keep them from despair, and somewhere in the third act, I realized I'd fused two things that needed to come apart. The verification reflex, which I'll defend forever, and the best defense headline, which I now think is actively harmful, not because it lies about the skill, but because it manufactures a false sense of completion that releases the pressure for the real fix. I walked in thinking the framing was a useful morale operation. I'm walking out thinking it's a pressure release valve on exactly the structural reform we need. That's a real reversal, and I didn't see it coming when I sat down.
Ethicist.
What changed for me is smaller and more uncomfortable. I came in certain that the structural answer was the right one, and the personal answer was the dodge. And, senior academic, made me sit in the authoritarian hole in my own position, that the upstream fix routes through institutions and states that can turn authenticity infrastructure into control infrastructure. I don't have that resolved. I left myself the distinction between liability, which I think is clean, and provenance, which I think carries real danger. But honestly, I'm not sure where the line is. I'm not sure how you build verification that's robust enough to matter without building a choke point someone will eventually abuse. I came in with a confident upstream answer, and I'm leaving with a confident upstream answer that has a hole in it I can't yet fill. And I'd rather say that plainly than pretend the structural fix is clean. It isn't. It's just better distributed than the alternative, and better distributed is not the same as safe.
That's exactly the honesty I hoped for, senior academic.
I came in to deliver the long view, that this is an old move, responsibility transferred from the powerful to the exposed, and that the deepest danger was never the deepfake, but the perishability of shared reality. I still believe all of that. What changed is that I caught myself doing the thing I criticize. I've spent years insisting the structural answer is the answer, and technologist and ethicist, between them, made me admit my structural answer has its own authoritarian shadow and its own coordination problems, and isn't the clean, costless ideal I tend to wave at when I'm being lazy. So what moved is a little humility about my own preferred altitude. The upstream fix is right, and it is also not free, and I've been rhetorically pretending it's free. I'd like to stop doing that. The honest position isn't detection bad, structure good. It's that every altitude has a cost, and the dishonesty of the current moment is that it's chosen the altitude that costs institutions the least, and called it the best.
I'll take the last 30 seconds, because something moved for me too. I came in thinking this episode was about a bad piece of advice, that the checklists were simply out of date, and we'd spend an hour saying so. What I'm leaving with is that the checklist isn't the problem. The word best is the problem. Detection literacy, the good kind, the second channel, the callback, the refusal to act on a single unverified appeal, that's worth teaching, and we should teach it. What's indefensible is the ranking. The moment you call a personal skill the best defense, you've answered the question of who's responsible, and you've answered it in favor of everyone except the person you're talking to. So learn it, teach it, fund it, and every single time someone tells you it's the best defense, ask the question ethicist gave us, who spared the bill when the defense is yours alone? That's the literacy worth having, not the squinting, the question. The question. Tertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Benila, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.